Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Today in The More Things Change, The More They Stay the Same, healthcare, again, taxes, still, also China, and some labor union history to boot. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, the 13th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Without putting too fine a point on it, the timeline for tax reform, one of the big things, as you know, that both Hill and White House Republicans say they want to get done this year, well, that timeline has been flexible. Now, though, as we head into the autumn of this legislative session, some meat is being put on them calendar bones. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan said today we are going to see an outline of what Congress and the White House have been talking about tax-wise the week of the 25th of September. This September, I should say. So, soon. That apparently was the signal for interested parties to lay out their vision for the American tax code. Texas Republican Ted Cruz gave a talk today at the Tax Foundation. He wants a flat tax, also to be able to file his taxes on a postcard, but also, and more in the realm of legislative reality, something called full and immediate expensing.
One of the most important reforms that we ought to include in tax reform is full and immediate expensing. If you spend money on capital, you should expense that immediately. Now, why? What does that mean?
Senator, we are so glad you asked that question. Here's Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
Full and immediate expensing. It sounds daunting, but put really simply,
full expensing allows you to immediately write off or deduct the cost of your purchases in the year that you make them.
John Traub is the head of the Tax Policy Group at Deloitte Tax. There are some businesses that would benefit from this idea way more than others. Steel companies, factory farms. Adam Chodoro is a tax law professor at Arizona State University's Law School.
What expensing does is it significantly lowers the tax rate of those companies that buy heavy equipment.
He says accounting firms, lawyers, consultants, on the other hand, businesses that don't buy all that much expensive equipment might push back because this change wouldn't help all that much.
So one of the key fights that we're going to see is actually within the business community.
And even the industries that you might guess would be gung-ho on the idea are waiting on this one. Jim Gould is a consultant to the Crane Coalition, a business group that's purpose is to support accelerated depreciation. It's a thing.
The one thing that's clear is that the shift in thinking toward full expensing of capital costs will not be by itself. It will be a part of a package.
And a tax reform package would need to come up with money for the change. A cutback in interest deductions, maybe. Spinach, Gould calls it. Spinach that may be tough to swallow. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
More to come the next couple of weeks, by the way, on what are going to be some of the big line items in that eventual tax package. All right, moving on. We talk about the bond market here every now and then. Today, a variation of sorts. In the wake of Harvey and Irma, what's known as the catastrophic bond market has been on a wild ride. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has the what and the why.
When something like a hurricane happens with not tens or hundreds, but thousands of insurance claims all coming in at once, your provider needs a big old pile of cash to cover them. Enter reinsurance.
Reinsurance is insurance for insurance companies.
Robert Hartwig directs the Risk Management Center at the University of South Carolina. He says insurance companies taking out their own insurance was working fine until
Hurricane Andrew shook the industry to its core, and we saw a lot of reinsurance capacity being withdrawn from markets like Florida.
Reinsurance companies saw Florida's risk and politely declined to keep covering it. But all those homeowners still wanted coverage, and their local insurance companies wanted to sell it to them. The result, Hartwig says, was to transfer that insurance risk to the financial markets with a new product, the catastrophe bond.
The cat bond market's about $25 billion outstanding, and about half of the market has some exposure to Florida.
Paul Schultz is CEO of Aon Securities, which helps issue cat bonds. He explains how they work. Investors are betting disaster won't strike a certain area in a usually 1 to 3 year period. If they're right, the bond pays off big, with yields like 8 or 10%. That's drawn a wide array of investors, including pension funds and university endowments. But if they're wrong...
Oh, goodness. There's a risk of 100% loss of principal.
Says Gary Martucci of S&P Ratings. Irma drove prices for cat bonds down by half at one point. But when the storm turned left, prices mostly recovered. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Meh, you know, whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Before tax reform was the bright, shiny legislative object in Washington, it was health care. But lest you think that debate is over with, permit me to introduce you to the Medicare for All Act introduced in the Senate today by Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders. Its prospects in Congress are slim, we should say, but at its heart is a concept that A, keeps on popping up, and B, could use a little explaining. A single-payer healthcare system is what Sanders and 15 of his Democratic colleagues are calling for. We called Sarah Cliff at Vox to shed some light. Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, great to be on.
Tell me, would you, what single-payer means?
Single-payer essentially means that the government runs one health insurance plan for everybody. So you, me, your parents, your kids, we'd all be on the exact same health insurance plan.
And the payer here is then the government, right?
Exactly. So when we talk about single payer, we're really just saying the government is paying for everybody's health insurance.
Okay. How are they going to do that? They're going to raise taxes or what?
That is a great question. The Sanders bill lays out some options for how to finance it, but it doesn't say two key things. First, how much is this going to cost? How much it costs to give everybody health insurance? And second, which options they prefer. So right now, Sanders has a pretty comprehensive look at what benefits he wants his health insurance plan to cover, but very little detail on how to pay for that plan.
One does imagine, though, that taxes are going to have to go up somehow.
Yeah, and I think the case that Sanders would make is that, you know, we will no longer be paying the premiums we currently pay to our private insurance,
right.
That it will change who we're paying, but a lot of middle-class Americans wouldn't necessarily be paying more. But you're right, Kai, that taxes are definitely going to have to go up. There's really no way to build a big government health insurance company without doing that.
Right. To be explicit here, this means the health insurance that you and I get through work, that goes away. The Obamacare exchanges, that goes away. Or some, they go away as we know them now.
Yeah, that's right. So also Medicare, Medicaid, they all sunset 4 years after this bill passes, and we all move into something totally new that doesn't exist yet called universal Medicare. So we would no longer, you know, you would not have the Marketplace plan. I would not have the Vox plan. Those would cease to exist under the Sanders plan.
We know that this faces, I guess we could fairly say, extremely long odds in the Congress of the United States. What do you know about how the population at large feels about it?
We know that public opinion generally tilts in favor of single payer, but it's very malleable. It's really easy to tell people things about single payer and make them like it more or like it less. So I think we're not really decided right now. And I think that's why Democrats are kind of seizing on it. They feel like they can really take this message and run with it in the middle of this repeal debate that Republicans have been having.
Right. One more thing before I let you go. The Sanders plan is not the only plan introduced and announced today. There's another thing that's now formally on the table. It is, I think Vox has called it, the last healthcare reform plan standing, Cassidy Graham. What is it and what does it do?
Yeah, so this is kind of the last Republican repeal plan that's hanging around. It would essentially take all the money in the Affordable Care Act, the marketplaces, the Medicaid expansion, divvy it up among the states and say, you know, you use this how you see fit. And it would really advantage states that have not expanded Medicaid, particularly a lot of Republican states, disadvantage the big states like California or New York that have expanded Medicaid. So it doesn't seem like it's going to have enough time to get anywhere. Republicans need to wrap this up by September 30th. But it means the Obamacare repeal debate, it is not officially over as long as this one last option is hanging out there.
Sarah Cliff, she's a senior policy correspondent at Vox. Sarah, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The racial disparity in drug-related sentencing in this country is an established fact. Blacks are arrested and go to jail at far higher rates than whites for the same drug crimes. There is also, it turns out, racial disparity in drug-related opportunity, which is becoming clear as marijuana becomes an above-board and booming industry. Most of the profits and proceeds from the 30% bump in sales last year to $7 billion worth of marijuana is going to whites. So some states are trying to create a more level playing field, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
It's a scorcher of a day in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, and nearly 1,000 people are lined up to apply for just 25 jobs. There aren't a lot of decent-paying jobs around here, and these are double the minimum wage with benefits. Bobby Boyd was near the front of the line. For years, he's been bouncing around in lots of low-wage jobs.
Assembly line work, American Textile, Amazon, a lot of warehouse work.
You can come in and sign in over here.
Today, he's endured the sweltering heat to break that cycle and get in on the ground floor of a new industry that could revive McKeesport's economy, medical marijuana. Since U.S. Steel left the area in the 80s...
The McKeesport has had its struggles, obstacles and challenges have been tremendous. It's been a battle over the last few decades.
That's Mayor Michael Cherepko. He says the town's lost a third of its population and one in four people live in poverty. That line of medical marijuana job seekers, it runs down a main street where nearly every storefront is empty.
I see families throughout the city of McKeesport, you know, whether it's white, black, whatever the case may be. It's the same situation. I have people coming and asking about jobs, asking about employment.
And when the Pure Penn Medical Marijuana Facility opens here on the site of what used to be an iron pipe plant, workers will be learning nearly every aspect of growing and processing cannabis. If the industry takes off, this community could become a new kind of company town.
Good afternoon. What a great day for the city of McKeesport, for the Mon Valley.
That's Mayor Cherepko at the groundbreaking, a day that didn't happen by accident. When medical marijuana became legal in Pennsylvania, the law also required that disadvantaged communities like McKeesport get priority for growers' licenses and that minority job applicants get preference. Attorney Robert White says if blacks don't get in on the ground floor,
then that space just won't ever exist. What we will see is really a repeat of what we see, say, in the construction industry, where minority-owned businesses have to settle for these small subcontracts as opposed to really being some of the prime players.
White, a city council member in Washington, D.C., wrote legislation to encourage minority-owned businesses there to get preferences in the application process.
The government has played an active role in creating wealth disparities by race, then it must play an active role in trying to rebalance this.
If recent history is any guide, that won't happen on its own. Ezekiel Edwards with the ACLU has been tracking this industry. He says white-owned and staff marijuana businesses predominate in early adapter states like Washington and Colorado. That may be because blacks tend to earn less and not have the $500,000 they typically need to start a dispensary.
It's hard overnight to kind of think that you're creating a level playing field and then expect that communities that have been historically excluded from the same economic opportunities as whites would just be able to kind of pick up and join those industries as easily.
In fact, lots of states now have systems that give advantages to diverse applicants, but they come with strings. Here in Pennsylvania, for instance, people with marijuana convictions can't get jobs in the industry. Job seeker Bobby Boyd thinks that's unfair, even though it won't affect him.
A lot of people from the area was arrested on those charges. If they're making it a problem like that, then I think that they're trying to target a certain type of people.
But he says he's still hopeful that this new industry could mean better jobs for this beleaguered town. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we have a saying, it goes, make the table longer and bigger, not the wall taller.
The glass ceiling in organized labor straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow up 39 points today, about a tenth percent, 22,158. The NASDAQ up just 5 points, basically flat, 6460. S&P 500 up less than 2 points, flat there as well, 2498. Lots happening in retail today. Target said it's going to hire 100,000 holiday workers this year, 43% more than last year. Lots of them apparently are going to be in stores trying to help you find what you need. Think about that. Target shares up 2.7% today. Nordstrom is a public company for now. May not be for long. Reports today that a group of family members might be hiring a private equity firm to help fund a buyout. Nordstrom shares up almost 6% on that news today. Bonds down, yields up. 10-year T-note 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know that classic line from von Clausewitz, war is politics by other means? Here's another one. It's from me. Economics is politics by other means, too. China is getting ready to sell $2 billion worth of bonds this month. Not the Chinese renminbi equivalent of $2 billion, but bonds denominated in American greenbacks, something it hasn't done in years. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what gives.
If investors buy bonds from China using U.S. dollars, it means those investors are lending those dollars to China. So when China says it's offering dollar bonds, it's saying it wants to borrow dollars. The question is why?
China doesn't need this money.
Yukon Huang is at the Carnegie Endowment. You want to know how many dollars China's hoarded up?
$3 trillion of reserves.
So what is China up to?
China doesn't need the money, but it needs friends among the international investment community.
Friends. Ishwar Prasad teaches at Cornell. China lost a lot of investor friends over the past year when its currency depreciated and it imposed controls on money leaving the country.
This bond, small as it is a way of building relationships with the international community, saying we can give you good yields, we can give you safety.
It's basically a symbolic move to say China is cool, China's mature, China will give you your money back. Now, there's another reason China is borrowing dollars, even though it doesn't actually need dollars. Brad Setzer is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
It is doing this in order, almost certainly, to set a benchmark in the market.
How much should a Chinese business have to pay in interest if it wants to borrow dollars? I don't know. Nobody really knows. This is a way to find out. Whatever yield the market sets for these Chinese government dollar bonds, that's going to be the baseline for what other entities in China have to pay when they start borrowing dollars.
Large financial institutions, some provincial governments, some state enterprises might want to borrow in dollars, even private companies.
So the Chinese government doesn't need to borrow dollars, but the rest of China might. And this is a start. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Si se puede is a phrase you might know. Yes, we can. President Obama used it during his 2008 campaign. He stole it, actually, as he has admitted, from the United Farm Workers. Less commonly known, though, is who actually came up with it. Not, as you might think, Cesar Chavez. Dolores Huerta co-founded the UFW with Chavez in 1962. It's her line. And there's a new documentary out about Dolores Huerta, directed by Peter Bratt. Carlos Santana is the executive producer. Guys, thanks for coming to the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
How did this movie come to pass?
See the man sitting next to me?
Yes. Was it your idea?
Yeah.
How come?
Because I felt that her story needs to come to light so that other women specifically, and men, but specifically women all over the world, India, Africa, South America, can recognize the value of your inner superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for too long, women have been reduced to something that is not quite so with equality.
So much archival footage in this film, and a lot of interviews with her kids. She has 11 children. Mm-hmm. You spend a lot of time sitting down with the kids, and one of them says at one point, the movement was her favorite child.
Became her number one child.
Became her number one child, yeah. And that sort of hit me. I mean, the choices she made to serve those who can't serve themselves, as somebody else in the film says, had serious and lasting impact on her kids.
Right.
They talk about this.
Right. Before making the film, I knew a few of her children.
Oh, did you?
Since college
days. Oh, interesting.
They all fight for social justice in one way or another and really carried the same fire as their mother. And I just felt, in order to tell this story, it had to be a family story. You know, particularly as Latinos, the family is at the center of life, and I just felt that their voice, you know, would add so much dimension. And you do see the sacrifice. I do think certain individuals come to the planet missioned.
Oh yeah, that's pretty clear.
And she's definitely one of those those great souls that came here, you know, with a mission, children or no children.
Well, it's, so there's a joint interview with Dolores and Cesar Chavez, which you guys thread through the film. The interviewer asks Dolores, listen, and this, it's old, it's probably 1965, 68, whatever. The interviewer says, listen, if you got $5,000 and I said you had to spend it only on yourself, what would you do? And she said, I would, you know, spend it on the movement, in essence. That's what she said. Right. And the interviewer said, no, you can't do that. And she said, that's what I'm going to do. Sorry.
That's my life, she says.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's fascinating about Dolores. She went to college. She became a teacher.
Yep.
She's living a relatively middle-class life in the 1950s, early 60s. And she, you know, most stories are about a rag to riches.
Mm-hmm.
Hers is really the opposite. It's
around,
a riches to rags. She gives everything up, even her love of jazz. She wanted to be a professional dancer. She gives that up when she discovers her calling. And that's, you know, she wants to liberate farm workers. And that becomes her life mission.
There's an interview you guys do, Carlos, with Angela Davis, in which she talks about what was happening in the 60s in this country and how the time was ripe for what Dolores was trying to do, that it was a time where everybody thought that this kind of social justice and economic justice was possible.
Yeah, we call it consciousness revolution. Consciousness revolution is about thinking with a different mind. So we just believed that there was another way to coexist globally, collectively. And for me, it was easy because being at Woodstock, it was the proof right there that quality and quantity can go together, unity and harmony can go together, and that patriotism is prehistoric, that we need to get rid of flags, borders. We have a saying, it goes, make the table longer and bigger, not the wall taller.
Well, so out of that, I have to ask this question, Peter Bratt, parallels to today?
You think?
Right? I mean, this film comes at an interesting time.
I have to tell you, my brother here, and a lot of artists, they're tuned into another frequency.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not rationally, he knew, but somehow when he called me, there was an urgency in his voice. We have to tell this story right now. That was 5 years ago. That was before the election of Donald Trump, the pardoning of Joe Arpaio, the talk about building a wall, the striking down of DACA. I mean, there's an all-out war right now against Latinos. And as we saw in Charlottesville, you know, 8 years ago, we were supposedly post-racial when we had an African-American sitting in the White House. Come to find that elephant is still standing in the room. It's something we have not dealt with as a nation. And you couldn't, Dolores' story and her example, it's like an anecdote to what's happening right now politically. And we didn't foresee that when we started making this film.
One of the things Carlos Santana that she says at the end of this movie is the conversation at this point in the film had turned to her and her legacy, right? Because she has now become a symbol of so many things in this.
She's
society,
a symbol,
right?
But she's still
well, she's really active, right? I mean, it's not like she's in retired status.
There's nothing
right?
past
yeah,
tense.
No,
about
not, the nothing at all. And I didn't mean to imply that, but she says at one point near the end of the film, you know, I didn't used to believe that I should talk about my achievements because so much of this film is about her role in the UFW and how in the end she got forced out when Cesar died. She didn't get to run it. And she says, you know, I used to not talk about my achievements for me, but I don't believe that anymore. And she is now speaking out about women and what they can do in this economy.
There comes a point where you realize spirituality is certainty, not arrogance. Spirituality is celebrating you. We're tattooed in men in the mind with guilt, shame, judgment, condemnment, fear. I'm not worthy of God's grace. All that bullshit is exactly that. Mental slavery bullshit. I say it like this. Divinity is not in your DNA. Divinity is your DNA. So roll up your sleeves, create miracles and blessings.
It's a film called Dolores, Rebel, Activist, Feminist, and Mother, Carlos Santana and Peter Brandt. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you
for having us.
We have clips from that film, Dolores. You can check it out, marketplace.org. It's a good one. This final note on the way out today, an update on our efforts to get Richard Smith, the CEO of Equifax, on the program so we could ask him how it came to be that 143 million Americans had their personal data hacked on his watch. Mr. Smith had a piece in USA Today in which he apologized for the hack. So we called again this morning, invited him on. Here is the verbatim response we got from Equifax PR. As you can imagine, we are fielding a lot of these right now. I appreciate your understanding. End of quotes. We will keep on trying. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 39 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ and the S&P both basically flat. Brian Allison, Sarah Bergeri, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Dan Powell, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.